ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is Sean Duran, the head of design at Wiretap and also community organizer of Columbus Web Group and Columbus Startup Week. And we're going to talk about the web design equation today. This episode is brought to you by your productized consulting guide. Want to get started with productized consulting? This book will teach you step by step how to craft your offer, overcome client objections, write your sales page, and strategically plan your services line. To get your copy, head over to uibreakfast.com/productized and use your special promo code podcast20 on checkout to get 20% off any book package. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Jane. How's it going?
Doing great. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. It's fun.
Fantastic. Before we get started on the main topic, could you please tell us a bit more about yourself, or what you do, and how you got started in design in general?
Yeah, totally. So I guess I'll start in the beginning of my life and work my way there. It'll be short. I'm not going to do my whole life story. Even though I will. So I've been in the Midwest for my whole life here in America. My dad is from Cleveland, Ohio. My mom actually by herself immigrated to America when she was just 18. They met and I was born in Cleveland. And ever since I was young, I was into like figuring out systems and just like pushing their boundaries at like a very young age. So I don't know if you've ever played Sonic, like Sonic.
No, I played Mario.
Oh, you're Mario. I always feel like there's two kinds of people. There's like the Sonic people, the Mario people. I don't know the difference between us, but it's something. So yeah, from like a very young age, like I beat Sonic 2 when I was 3 on the Sega Genesis, and I feel like if there was Twitch back then, my parents could have made a lot of money. So I was always into figuring out how to make things work, and even at my dad's card shop, he sold like Magic the Gathering, Pokemon, baseball cards, and comic books. Since I had like a very unfair advantage of like access to all the cards known to man, essentially. I like to like play within the crazy boundaries of like, okay, normally people make decks to win within like Magic or Pokemon, but I just wanted to make the most insane things that still like got the outcome I wanted, but just like off the wall ideas that never made sense. So that's where I sort of started getting into like systems, even though I didn't really understand that. And throughout my whole life, I've been into like music, photography, video, not really art. And I didn't realize that until I went to college at Ohio State here in Columbus, where I still am, that like UX was a thing, user experience. And I got a major in a very convoluted title, which is like new media and communication technology with emphasis in human computer interaction, essentially UX. So it combined all of my love for like this like media aspect along with the humans and figuring out human behavior and systems to make like someone happy, hopefully, and elicit response. And that's a little bit of how I got here. And right now, yeah, wonderful. I work at Wiretap as the head of design. So marketing, app, the product itself, and anything in between.
Could you tell us a bit more about Wiretap? What kind of products you're building there?
Yeah, so it's not like a secret shadowy thing. We do get random phone calls all the time. As you probably expect, people think that we are hacking into their lives. We're listening through the microwave, things like that. They're sort of fun, sort of sad. But we do large scale, like enterprise scale, visibility, compliance, and governance into collaboration platforms like Slack, which we Before this started, we were talking about how we both sort of know about Slack, along with like Microsoft Teams, Workplace by Facebook, which is essentially Facebook for work, even though they hate saying that. They're probably going to pound me for saying that, but it's the best way to think about it. But it has like business steroids injected into it, so it's a little bit more friendly for the enterprise, along with some AI-infused funny business going on there for insider threats and toxicity detection and stuff like that. So that's the elevator speech for what we do.
Wonderful. You also mentioned that you do community work in your hometown, Ohio, yeah. And there's been a number of podcast guests here that you personally know there.
Yeah, which is crazy. There's Val, which you just had on the last episode or two ago. Twice. She's like a repeat. You must really like her.
We just clicked together on the big topic of email, you know.
Yeah, it makes sense. Especially for like your audience of like founders, enterprise SaaS, or yeah, software SaaS people. And then there's like David Sherry of Debt to the Stock Photo, and then Dennis Fields of like Envision. So yeah, mm-hmm. Midwest people. Being cool.
Wonderful. So for the web design equation, the way I found out about the topic is because I was browsing your work and came across an old podcast episode of yours talking about that. And I really, that really, really resonated with me in trying to, you know, break down the web design process into components which resemble an equation, a mathematical equation. So tell us a bit how you came up with such approach, now that I know your story with all these card playing and hacking, and hacking in a good sense, of course. tell us how you arrived at that.
Yeah, so I, for whatever reason, whenever I need to make sense of something and like in my mind things are jumbled up, I resort to some kind of systematic way to like break things down to make it a bit more manageable for me. And an equation is like one aspect of that. Along with, I have lots of crazy mind maps. I have one that's called like the Grand Unifying Theory of Why You Do What You Do and What You Can Do About It. It looks like something out of a beautiful mind, lots of string around everything, lots of connections. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I came up with it just because I was having trouble tackling just a large project and breaking it down into something that's a bit more manageable, but also built upon ideas like atomic design, and added a little bit of nuance to that. So that's like the biology chemistry idea, and mine was like the more like calculus mathematical idea to designing for I guess essentially the web or anything that has like responsiveness built into it.
If we translate that to plain English, the concept that I came across, I could say that it's about defining what the project is about, writing down project specs and definitions before you get started in there. And we're going to talk about constraints, variables, constants, maximums and minimums, and other different things. And anyone who has been in design knows that, you know, defining the task is probably equally important, if not more important, than executing it well. So tell us a bit about this, and maybe let's start with atomic design as your first framework that was described there.
Yeah, totally. With atomic design, it was an idea like created by Brad Frost, essentially, how breaking down a web page into five different sections. Essentially, there's atoms, which are like really single, solitary, small little things, like an H1 or an H2, or just like a paragraph tag, very small things. And then going up the ladder, there is molecules, which is like combining one or two atoms together, such as a button, that since it has like a button plus some text, or there's an icon within the button. And then building from there, organisms is just like a more complex idea of a molecule, where you can have multiple molecules together, maybe a molecule plus an atom, such as like a search bar itself, or like a header bar with the navigation in it. And then a template would be a combination of organisms. Essentially, it's an empty page. It's pretty naked. It's a skeleton. And then when it's fully fleshed out, there you throw in the actual content that will go in there, which if you are to design something, content is usually one of the first things that you should start off with. But these starting in the beginning with like smaller elements, it helps break down just the design process a little bit easier to manage, easier to chew on. But in the end, that when you want to create a nice experience, it should be involved the content itself, but also the context of someone. So that is, I think, in essence, atomic design.
I think with modern tools like Sketch and Figma that are specifically built for UX, it makes a lot of sense. And I've seen a lot of articles, I'll include one in the show notes, where designing with elements first as, you know, components or whatever they're called in software makes a great technical process for UX.
Oh yeah, totally. And then I don't know about you, but have you ever gotten into with like Sketch with symbols or I forget what Figma calls them, the reusable components?
Yeah. I've been just using Figma for the first week, like last week. So it's so interesting to see how these things are built both in Sketch and Figma, and how like, so this topic that we're discussing today is pretty hot.
Oh yeah, totally.
For me, So
how are
sorry
you
for interrupting
it?
You. Figma. Oh, I think it's the wonderful thing is being cross-platform, and also live collaboration is an amazing thing. Everything else is somewhat pretty competitive to Sketch, so I wouldn't call them like super different from each other. Learning curve was very small.
Yeah, I was just exploring Figma myself, just because just trying to figure out maintainability of our like design files and systems, and also how like to integrate with actual real life code to make the process of going from design to like actual implementation faster. Because I know Figma has APIs which help, just like you can feed in colors and components to the dev team to make that workflow a lot easier. So it's exciting times in the design world.
Yeah, it's not exactly super new. There's been Zeppelin in Sketch also has a lot of other plugins in it. Definitely. Previously, for example, to get feedback on my design, I had to export PNGs somewhere. Usually put them like in Dropbox paper and a lot of descriptions around it. But now I can just share the file and people jump around that, which is pretty magical if you think about it.
It is. I've been getting into Figma lately too, and it's I can see the possibilities, but also the web-only component is like both a good thing and bad thing. So I don't know, picking up like where to put your stake in the ground of where you're going to put all your design stuff. Especially if you're like a product owner or founder, I don't know, it feels like it influences your thinking behind your product itself. Cause then you're limited by the constraints of whatever tool you use, and how that tool will grow alongside your company. So it's always interesting to see how that influences just an industry.
Yeah, wonderful. That was a great sidetrack to talk about a little bit new tools, which is always exciting. Yeah. So from atomic design, let's go back to the constraints, variables, and other things.
Totally. If we're going to continue that idea, go into like the web design equation of sorts, this is where it actually involves with the idea of these reusable components within design tools like Sketch or Figma or Framer or InVision Studio. You can probably just keep listing them off. But there is the idea of like having something reusable or something that's constant throughout an application or a user flow that you might be designing. Things such as like a brand logo, some color templates, typography. Those are mostly going to stay the same. You can change them every now and again, but you probably won't do it every week and definitely not every month. But having those sort of set up as core foundational aspects where I know if you study typography at all, it's a, like you want to base pretty much everything around like the body text, and like the M height or the X height. I always confuse the actual like technical terms of typography. but having things based around that and spacing and things. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that actually none of these tools have yet implemented the perfect hierarchy of styles, which, for example, InDesign can do for you when one style is based upon the other, because you always have to define all the styles separately, which in Sketch, for example, can be a big, big mess.
Yeah, share. If I were to share like our Sketch libraries that we use at Wiretap, there's a lot of hacks that you got to do to make them a bit more reusable with all your colors and states and variables within there. Which actually it sort of feeds into like the next part of the equation, which is like the things that are variable in nature.
For example, Figma takes every component separately as a style, and Sketch combines everything as a style together, and none of that is perfectly comfortable, but you never know like which of that is going to be applicable. For example, what really drives me nuts is that text is combined with its alignment in a style in Sketch. So you have to do like, left align, small text, left line, small text, right line, and other really silly things.
There's just like, I think if you want to do like all of the size of like H1 to H6, body tag, paragraph tag, paragraph tag, quote tag, and then all the alignments within Sketch, you just have like hundreds of styles and symbols. It's a bit crazy. And that's where I think Figma has a hand up right now, just for the ease of use with that.
Yeah, just loving it for the alignment part, for the beginners. Yeah, and it's probably one of the first episodes where I'm really derailing the main conversation to talk about other stuff, because it's been so painful lately. So the constraints and variables are things that you find in each project and that you need to define before you dive into design. Right.
Totally. Yeah. If you're listening to this podcast and you're like walking the dog, working out or anything like that, variables are the things that will probably bite you in the butt if you aren't paying attention. So that could be anything from like the text length of like a headline, or if you have a dashboard, some kind of key metric, along with like how much user data that you'll be displaying. If you have like a table, what happens when you shrink that table? How do you deal with that variable of screen width and height? And even also like input devices, you aren't really guaranteed even if you have a 27 inch screen with whatever that translates into pixels, you might not be guaranteed that you'll have a mouse to point and click through your system. So are your touch targets for your things that you interact with at least like a minimum of like 30 to 40-ish pixels wide and high, just to actually do something well with your little stubby little fingers? and that's where I think lots of people, especially myself, if you're just starting out with a product or you're trying to like revamp one from the ground up, or you're just doing some quick fixes, that's where lots of the variability, that's where it bites you, just because there is a lot to think about there. And that's where if you approach it from like the mobile first, like the smallest screen size or input size possible, and then working from there, it's sort of like starting from just walking, and you have not that much space, or you're not doing too much. But once you get more and more real estate, you can actually build upon it and add things rather than doing the hard part of starting huge and then subtracting things, and then you don't know what to cut, really, which I find is an interesting thing, that humans just don't like the idea of losing things, but like gaining things is what we sort of seek out.
Well, in fact, making things too much is all as much of a problem as too little, really, design. Another approach to take is probably just to think as simple as possible about everything and using traditional patterns instead of some crazy unconventional layouts, which which don't translate to anything anywhere besides your own monitor where you thought about it.
Totally. Unless you're a genius and it's like, oh yeah, you've just changed the game on how people interact with their computers, which is like, hey, good for you. But I think a majority of us, if you wanted to bet the whole farm on your whole company or your whole product on that, I don't know. You'd have to have lots of gusto to go along with that.
You mentioned variables biting you in the back. I love that. I love that metaphor, because literally that's like say number one of a UI designer that's new, exactly, because they design something for their ideal piece of content, which can be longer, can be shorter, so everything looks like it's an orphanage, or it can be missing entirely and there is no placeholder. So there's so much to think about.
Yeah, totally. And that's where like having real data to like fill in mockups or anything like that, to get away from lorem ipsum, like people have long names. I don't know about you, but I have a really long name, and to fill it out in forms sometimes is impossible.
I can tell you have overcome this problem by inventing a nickname for your a short professional name for yourself.
Oh yes, yes, yeah. So yeah, Sean Duran is normal. But yeah, my whole name is like Sean Patrick John Paul George Ringo Duran. I have a lot of middle names.
Oh, so and in your legal stuff, you have to put all of them. Oh, I'm so sorry about that.
It's okay. I always usually have like a 5 to 10 minute conversation with whoever I have to fill out the form with. Like, hey, do you really need my whole name? Okay, let's do this.
Great. So that were variables, definitely an important part. And constraints. What are the constraints?
Yeah. So with constraints, when I originally thought this up, it was really based on like if you have like a browser matrix, like something that you're set out, like, hey, we're going to support this version of IE, Firefox, Chrome, Safari, and then everything else we will just sort of forget about, or we're going to do in like a progressive enhancement, or I forget the other opposite one was like graceful degradation. I think that's what it is. So I guess drawing a line, like that's what you're working within, and how you can sort of make sure that when you're doing what you're doing, you know, like what those boundaries are. And not only that, if you have to always know like your audience, who's actually going to be using your product. So for say someone that is within like a restaurant or bar environment, it's going to probably be in a dark setting. So whatever the screen is, it probably shouldn't be just pure white. You also have to think about bandwidth concerns. Is there going to be a lot of internet going on? Are you going to create like a progressive web application which has like an offline mode? Will it do a smart syncing when there is available time at a certain time, like a time of day? And not only the technological constraints, it's just like, how much time do you have, really? How skilled are you in this one area? Is it better for someone else to do it? And like, is the frameworks that you might be using, Are you fighting against them, or are you working with them? Because I've always found that if you ever want to do anything custom and you try and push against the constraint of whatever framework that you are using, you do 9 times out of 10 regretting it, because then the framework might update and then you have like an unsupported thing that you built on top of that's just now like, oh, now we have to do more work now instead of doing the right thing earlier. So that's my feelings on the constraints of designing stuff and actually building it out. I don't know about you and how you're building out user lists. I know that you had some constraints with some policies going on.
Oh, we just had a conversation before recording this podcast about GDPR and other things. But yeah, that's topic for a separate discussion, probably.
Totally.
But however, it's really awesome to be living these days when web standards have more or less come to the same common denominator, mm-hmm. and we don't have to worry about that much. However, all these things that you described still stand. And mostly that's about thinking about the user.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it usually ends up like if you're thinking about the user, you'll probably be better off. That's crazy enough.
Right. Yeah. And the last piece, the last component of your framework is maximum and minimums, which I mm-hmm. guess kind of apply to the variable part of the equation. So you have to think about what's the maximum value and what's the minimum value for something, or what is that about?
Yeah, that's exactly it. The whatever that if you are thinking of like a content management system like WordPress or HubSpot or Squarespace, there it might be like a maximum allotted amount of text or like character count, or there might be a minimum one. Especially if you're designing for an article-based site where you have to show some things. There's always different amount of constraints within there, and that's where the variables can bite you in the butt. If you are designing just for a perfect scenario rather than with real data, or even not with real data, if you have to have mock data. I know I love to use Mockeroo.com. It just mm-hmm. generates a hell of a lot of everything that you ever want. And it's all pretty realistic. So it gives you whatever form you like. If you like JSON, that can then be reused in lots of applications like Sketch. If there is a Sketch to JSON plugin, I forget what it is. It might be through Envision, but then you can populate your whole UI with actual real stuff. So that way, when you come to the prototyping phase, if you have one, hopefully you do, but something like Envision or Sketch or any kind of mock-up tool and user flows thing, you can then have a better sense of like, oh, okay, this is way too many things, or this is too much or too little, and how that really influences the experience of the whole application product itself.
What about the minimums?
Minimums, yeah, I usually start at the minimums as the starting point of anything, really, just because it's easier to work within, like, okay, I have to have at least this, or the screen size usually can get to this size, width, or height, and then go from there. That's where, like, the mobile-first design strategy sort of comes in, rears its head. But also with, like, any kind of website connection, if let's say you have a poor Wi-Fi connection, you're just trying to load a page, how much that page weighs really affects someone's experience. But also, like, if you have a data plan and you are paying per megabyte, and for like some developing countries, if your product and you have like a marketing website that is targeted to those people, it's like you're just really costing them tons of money just to download a really high resolution image that might look good, and it probably does, but it really it impacts someone's life drastically.
So sad to hear. I think one one introduction, technical introduction of the last years mm-hmm. was Retina displays. Mm-hmm. And we all assume that everybody's sitting there with their amazing Retina displays, which is not the case. The whole Windows world doesn't have proper Retina implementation, even on high-res displays.
Yeah, totally. And I also think with that, there's like accessibility in mind. Having some kind of way to like navigate throughout your site. Like hopefully there is like, I know with color contrast ratios, there's like the WCAG ratio guidelines of like what's acceptable or not. And usually I try for like the AA standard of like the minimum color contrast ratio, just so things are legible for people that don't have the best eyesight. They can still see, but it's hard for them to see low contrast things, which is just good design in general.
Yeah, and especially that and light fonts and super mm-hmm. light things, it's all big things to consider.
Yeah.
And going back to minimums, in web design that's kind of solved with responsive websites, and it's not mm-hmm. new and hard anymore.
No.
But for as someone who focuses on the internals of web applications, it's mm-hmm. always a challenging question, what is the minimum screen resolution that we should support? Because obviously we're not going to support mobile phones and tablets. But for myself, the solution, I don't know if it's the perfect one, was to start with the smallest MacBook that I can imagine. I think it's 12-inch something. So mm-hmm. that's something that where can people still do work. And so we just play from there. I don't know if it's a good solution or not. What's been your great practice there?
So I do have a lot of experience designing for like internal apps and stuff for large corporations. Before at Wiretap, I was actually at Nationwide Insurance, really big 50,000-ish company, 50,000-ish employee company right here in Columbus, Ohio.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people going on that. And what's nice is we did have analytics in the sense of like we knew like the types of devices that people would be accessing our stuff from, but also the screen resolutions of the people that did actually access the stuff that we did. And sometimes that is both a good thing and bad thing. Reason why it's a good thing is because you know definitively like, yep, these are the sizes, this is the resolution. If we don't have a lot of time, money, or anything like that, we could focus on optimizing those experiences above. But when you do that and you keep getting people using those devices, of course, you'll keep getting more validating results saying like, yeah, people keep coming to this site more and more often with these kinds of devices. And that's because if people visit it on a different device that like maybe your phone or iPad, it wouldn't work that well. So they've learned not to do it. So that impacts your results, which then feed into the decision of, oh, okay, now we don't have to worry about that because no one uses it. Well, no one uses it because it sucks. So I luckily, everything I've ever really done, it's always been like you can do it on your phone, even though technically maybe it wouldn't make sense to, just because I know that people have constantly tried to, or people have always resorted to their phone more and more and more to do things that we never expected them to do on their phone, such as like shopping for beds. Like I bought my bed on my phone, like mm-hmm. not Casper, but it was just like another thing. But more and more often, as long as I can do it on my phone, I probably will, just because it's on me 24/7. And if it's easy enough, there's no reason not to do it. That said, it's then the designer's challenge and burden to make that actually feasible, which sometimes just might not be in the scope or the product roadmap right at that point in time, especially if you don't have customers or if you're like pre-launch or pre-market.
So... since this is a pretty important topic for me, have you designed fully yeah. responsive mobile apps, like really complex tools, B2B, that's where we're at. So you make them fully responsive for your audience.
Yeah. It's a
It's a big task.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just like there, it doesn't feel like there's a good way of doing it. Things feel shoehorned in sometimes, just because if you're trying to add a lot of enterprise-y functionality, things can get convoluted because there's just so much variability and options that go along with that. But making the best, sort of optimizing for like, what do most people do most of the time? And then everything else, trying to aim to help with, but, doing that, like the 80-20 rule, really focusing on that when you get to that, those smaller sizes, and then working from there and just adding value when you can.
Oh, that's a great tip. Thank you for sharing. Yeah. Well, summing up, I think today's conversation really helped us to bring together all these multiple requirements that all projects have, so that starting from scratch isn't really starting from scratch, because you have so many things on your in your equation already when you get started, right?
Yeah, totally.
Could you think of some nice examples when that really helped you out in a client project or in your company project?
Yeah, totally. I know the most recent one, the biggest one, would probably be when we were revamping our Aware platform at Wiretap, when we're looking at how to show off incidents. So if someone posts something that gets flagged by the system, how we actually showcase all the information related to that in a way that makes sense, but also accounts for the fact that you want to show not just the message itself, but also like the conversation and the context around that. Because let's say if we were having a conversation, Jane, you're like, oh, I just got a new dog. And I was like, what the hell? That might, or some other word than hell.
might
spark a thing, but in essence it wasn't like a bad thing, and without having that context around that message, there would be no way of knowing like, oh, that wasn't like a shocking thing or someone revealed something horrible, but like I was just really surprised that you got a dog because you never talked about getting a dog before. But incorporating that and like how to then go from this one, the current state of just showing like a snippet of the one message to like a whole threaded thing, and doing that smartly, was it's a challenge, but it's sort of cool as we work with like our data science team as to all this like awesome things that we can learn from, just like the network analysis stuff and how to really get more of a quantified sense of conversations, as well as a qualitative idea of it. So that would be like the last example.
What kind of methods, so that our listeners can see the parallels between these variables and the real life project? Which was the challenging part? Was it about constraints, or what was that was challenging and was resolved, and how?
Yeah. So what was challenging is the variable idea of like when a conversation starts and ends.
So figuring out that context, what context actually means in real life.
Yeah, because if you're using something like email, it's a little bit more known as like you send and receive, but with chat, there's like this always on aspect. It's more casual and people have like multiple conversations at once sometimes, or they just send one person a link and then it's done. Like there isn't like anything else. They had a real conversation in real life and they're like, hey, can you send me that file? Like, oh yeah, cool. And then they send them a file and then the conversation, quote unquote, is done. So that's one thing that's crazy hard to work within, but it's also it's a gut feeling thing as well, how we would finally tune that And also, like, just the constraint of we don't know all the aspects of what they're doing. So we have, like, the messages and the context around that. But as we work to integrate more and more platforms, we'll have a better picture of, like, the employee itself rather than these smaller aspects. So it's just a building block, foundational stuff that we're doing now. But we are designing and thinking of, like, that future vision of, like, okay, if we have more and more things, the constraints are less and less and less. It's just the idea of then providing value instead of sort of reducing risk for companies with that, like, unified view of employees.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for sharing that example. Sean, as we're wrapping up today's conversation, where can people find you and your awesome work online?
So you can find me physically in Columbus, Ohio.
That's great.
If you are in Columbus, let me know. Totally down for meeting up. Right in the brewery district, so pretty downtown. Online, I am SPJPGRD. Literally everywhere, that username is not taken. It's just a jumble of letters, which is my initials. And then my website is spjpgrd.com. Nothing much going on there. It's more of like a landing page right now as I try and figure out what I want to do with it. As I have, like, a lot of blogs I've written, I've just not published anything in a long time. Just trying to figure out how to approach everything. So
wonderful. It's great. I was going to ask you about all these usernames, and now we know another story. That's your amazing number of middle names. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for joining us today, for sharing your wisdom, and I hope these little bits will help our users design great web pages. Thank you, Sean, and have a great day.
No problem. You too.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.